the King of Connecticut, Matt Granahan, the man who has done so many things in MMA, pro wrestling, the entertainment biz. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
I'm very good, thank you. Now, you, well, some people know you as the Granimal. You now have the King of Connecticut moniker. How did that all come about?
Well, the King of Connecticut played on the regionality here in America. And what happened was, I was doing some pro wrestling here in the Southeast, and I was born and raised in Connecticut. And in a lot of these small towns where they run the shows, it's like they're still fighting a civil war. They're very resistant to the Yankees coming down and taking all their jobs and coming down here with the flasher and flair and the money. And I played that up to the hilt with the King of Connecticut character, and I utilized the blue blood accent from the Northeast. And that actually was somewhat legitimate. I grew up in Fairfield County. I grew up right outside of New York, 40 miles from Manhattan. And I based the King of Connecticut gimmick, if you will, on my ex-girlfriend Christy's dad. That goes way back to when I was in high school. And they lived in a town called Wilton, Connecticut. And whenever I was over there, he would say, "You and Christy can retire to the billiard room. I'm going to get some shut-eye for the evening." And he had a nice collection of cars and was a really cool guy, but kind of like a Thurston Howell type character. Also from England, I based a lot of that on Higgins from the old Magnum P.I. show.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that kind of culminated for me where they were taking the rebel flag down from the State House here in South Carolina. And there were protests on both sides. And the night that the flag was coming down, I was on a show. Actually, had come down earlier that day. I was on a show out in Boiling Springs, South Carolina. And I went out to the ring, had the flag tucked in my backside of my jumpsuit. And I took it out, giant rebel flag, and I talked about how Governor Haley had surrendered it at the feet of the King of Connecticut. And not since the War of Northern Aggression had the state of Connecticut had such power and influence over South Carolina. So it obviously got a lot of boos and heat from the crowd.
And, I was talking to, I was talking to an interview with DDP the other day, and he said, being a heel is much more fun than ever being a face. Do you find that to be true?
Absolutely. And DDP is awesome. We 2 weekends ago, we were helping a young lady who was named Marissa Rude, who's ravishing Rick Rude's daughter. DDP and I were helping her to get some bookings here for some pro wrestling shows. I'm managing a team now called Reality Check, the Real Shooters of MMA, and it's Phil Baroni, New York Badass Phil Baroni, and UFC Hall of Famer Stephen American Psycho Bonner. So two marquee UFC guys with great over-the-top personalities, definitely both heels. And Marissa, we're going to have as their valet. And DDP is awesome, man. He thinks he can get her in WWE. I don't know if anyone's familiar with her, but she was on stage at the Hall of Fame in Orlando when her dad went in the Hall of Fame, and she was just absolutely drop-dead gorgeous and just a sweet girl, and she wants to get into the business. And DDP helps us a lot, too, with tweets. We all use the DDP yoga, you know, getting older. I'm well into my 40s, and a lot of the guys that I work with and represent, the older fighters, like Phil Baroni and Kamal Chalarus, who've gone into the pro wrestling world, are needing that DDP yoga or DDPY to help. And he does an awesome time cross-promoting with us.
Now, wrestling started quite early for you, and we're talking traditional Olympic-style wrestling, aren't we?
Yes, I started wrestling back in eighth grade. And I just went back actually to my alma mater, Norwalk High School, to do a fundraiser for the wrestling team. My old coach had contacted me through one of my buddies who's a fellow teammate and put me in touch with the new coach, and they're trying to buy new mats for the wrestling room and renovate the wrestling room. And we made it into a whole local news story. It was featured on News 12 Cablevision. I came back and headlined the show. It was a pro wrestling show to benefit the high school and benefit the wrestling team, and coach Job Fernandez. Had an awesome time. Dan the Beast Severn was there. He was the match before me, and I wrestled the guy from Ring of Honor, Cauliflower Chase Brown, who's getting a feature on him, which will be out next week. The New York Times is doing a feature on him. He's an amazing athlete, amazing character, but he was also a great amateur wrestler, and we put on a great show for the crowd there in my hometown, and it was pretty cool. And then Dan and I got to do a clinic, amateur clinic seminar for the team as well. So that was awesome. Yeah, I started wrestling very young. I started really 7th grade, but then competitively like in 8th grade.
Well, then you added judo to your freshman year in college as well, and then you started getting into submission wrestling particularly.
Yeah, judo. I started doing judo in college. I was summer after my freshman year, the dojo in Danbury, Connecticut. And that was actually how I got into pro wrestling at the same time, because there was my buddy Dave, who had wrestled for a rival school, was there in the summer training together in judo. And he said, "Hey, you know, I'm getting into pro wrestling." And I said, "How are you doing that? Because I've always had always wanted to get into pro wrestling." He said, "I'm going to Killer Kowalski School," which was big in Connecticut. Now, I never went to Killer Kowalski School. I just started doing matches with Dave, because this was like before the internet was really big, and you could go from town to town and have matches with the same guy. So that was kind of how I developed my wrestling style with the judo and amateur wrestling. That's why the style I have is in pro wrestling is a lot different. And I think looks a lot better, because it looks a lot more real, because I don't really ever take bumps. You know, we legitimately throw each other, obviously, you know, a predetermined outcome, but it looks a lot more legitimate, and I've always had fans, you know, tell me that.
Now, the big thing, I mean, over here in the UK, the last 10 or so years, things like UFC, Bellator, MMA have really blown up. You went from competing in wrestling to putting on your first MMA show. In fact, it was the first in South Carolina, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. With American Combat Association, I had was coaching for a school called COPPO MMA, Rich Giametta, here in South Carolina, and I had, I believe, 3 fighters on that first show that I was cornering, and then also we put on the show in conjunction with another promotion. We co-promoted it, and then we had the ISKA came in. It was a whole rigmarole, because that was when South Carolina was first legalized MMA. It hadn't been legal prior to that point. So it was a milestone, and that show was packed. It was at the arena in the Doubletree Hotel in Columbia, and that was a great time, those first few shows in South Carolina. Now it's kind of like anything else. It's been years. The newness is kind of worn off. They really don't draw the crowds for the local shows so much anymore here in South Carolina. South Carolina has also been unfortunate. South Carolina had the only 2 deaths in MMA in the U.S. And I think there might have been 1 or 2 more since, but I was actually present at both of those events, and one of them, I was with Kamal Shalarus, actually. We had just picked him up from the airport, and we were in Augusta, Georgia. So it was actually North Augusta, I think, South Carolina, or Aiken, somewhere around there. And the young man who unfortunately lost his life, he was a 155-pound fighter, but he was like 6'8". Now, you can imagine how skinny he was. He had really just a real super thin neck. And when he finally got taken down and he took the shots to the head, it was almost like a bobble doll. His head was bouncing off the mat. It was really, really unfortunate. And then the second one, the second death, was in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. It kind of gets into something that I talk about on my show. It was out there in Mount Pleasant. I was there with Matt Tran's camp. He was supposed to be in the main event. And we were back in the locker room, and this guy had a great fight. He lost, but he kind of gassed out. But he never could catch his breath. It had nothing to do with any damage he took in the fight. He just had a heart attack, and he died literally like 6 feet from me there in the locker room. And that was horrible, obviously. But what I found more disturbing was the reaction of the fans. They went into a frenzy. They started rioting. Because they were ending the show. The fans were just announced to the fans that the show was ending. So one of the things I get into on my show quite a bit is that the MMA fans, they tend to not be respectful, really, here in the United States. And you look online at a lot of the comments that they make, you know, and the keyboard warriors. It's like the way I put it is everybody thinks they can fight, but nobody would ever think that they could beat like a Tiger Woods in golf or beat a top tennis player. You know, like most guys would never even think that they could hold their own against Serena Williams in a tennis match. But at the same time, everybody thinks that they can fight, and there's sort of a weird aggression that goes along with it here in the States with the fans that's a little disturbing.
Now, you touched on it a little bit there, the American Combat Association. So it originally started out as your own MMA promotion, and you set alongside Kamau, and it was tell us a little bit more about your relationship with Kamau in general, and the American Combat Association.
Well, a lot of people, I think, misunderstand what the American Combat Association is. We were never really a fight promotion. We did some tournaments, and we co-promoted some shows. But our main thing was a clinic company. And we've been with the top clinic company over the years. We actually were featured in UFC Magazine back in 2011 with the clinics that we were doing. It started out with Kamau. I actually just had Pat Miletich on my show, and we were talking about it. That goes back to Texas when Kamau first came to the States. And he was such a great clinician, such a great coach. He was captain of the British Olympic team, actually, there in England in freestyle wrestling. And when he came to the U.S., he was just such a great coach that I started working with him doing clinics for other academies. And mainly our thing was wrestling for MMA, because wrestling in MMA is a little different. You have to modify it. But we also did youth wrestling clinics, and then brought in Dan the Beast Severn to do clinics with us, as well as Phil Baroni. And we put on some great clinics over the years. Got King Mo working with us now, doing some clinics. So it's been great for schools and for academies to get these top guys to come in. And the one thing that we've always done is we're so affordable. A lot of times when you get UFC stars to come in and do clinics, they charge a ridiculous amount. We've always worked with the schools and made it really affordable for everybody.
And there was also around this time there was developed the Chivalrous Integrated Combat System, SICS.
Yeah, that's actually came about as I was working with Eric Paulson, who is a friend of Kamal's as well, on a book we did together called Rough and Tumble. And when I was training out in CSW in California with Eric, I started to look at how he ran his business model with CSW, Combat Submission Wrestling, and every given weekend he knew where he was going to be. And he had schools all over the country and all over the world where he was doing clinics. And Ayrton and I spent a lot of time hanging out off the mat. He liked to have some pints, and we'd go out and have a few pints after practice. And that was how we started developing the book. But also he gave me the idea. He said, you know, what you need to do is you need to start putting a lot of your techniques online, you know, of your coaching techniques online. And he encouraged me to do that. And that was when I started doing that. That was probably about 2008. And he also said, you know, you guys need an exit strategy, because I wasn't doing the MMA, you know, full-time as a career, but guys that were, like Kamal, you know, need an exit strategy. And he had the best exit strategy, because he developed these basically certifications to where the clinics, that the schools would pay an annual certification to be certified by CSW. And then as a part of that, Eric would come out once a year to the school. And then he also had the camp where all the instructors would come for this camp to California to him to get recertified every year. So we took that model, Kamal and I, and we started to develop it and get some schools certified in SICS. And that was where that all came about. We grew it fairly well. We did some stuff internationally. We did some clinics there in England. We did some in Italy. We also did some out in the Far East when Kamal was fighting for ONE Fighting Championships, like in the Philippines. But we never grew it to the level that CSW is with Eric. I mean, Eric's really the man when it comes to that. He created that template, but we tried to use that template and had some success with it.
Now, you touched on the book there, Rough and Tumble, with Eric Paulson and J.D. Dwyer. Tell us a little bit more about what that book's all about.
Well, I call that book the definitive history of MMA and pro wrestling. And Eric was a world Shooto champion, MMA pioneer and legend. And Eric and I have similar background in the submission wrestling and catch wrestling stuff. I was very close. One of my best friends was Billy Wicks. And also I was very close with Frankie Kane. And Billy Wicks, before he passed away, he gave me a great endorsement on my LinkedIn, having trained under him for 7 years. So I learned a lot of the old techniques, and Eric had as well in Japan. So this book traces history from England to the U.S., out to Japan and Brazil. There in England, we cover Billy Riley's Snake Pit. In Wigan, we cover British influences, people like Billy Robinson. We cover the Gracie family and their carnival wrestling history. And also, we cover Mitsuyu Maeda, the one who taught the Gracies. Initially came out of the carnies. So it's a history that not a lot of people know about. It's a complete history on MMA and pro wrestling and the origins of it. And it goes all the way back to the late 1800s with Evan Lewis and Farmer Burns, and traces things all the way to today. So people can see where the roots of MMA and pro wrestling, where it actually really comes from.
Was there a definitive moment then where pro wrestling and kayfabe came in?
You know, it's so debatable, because pro wrestling came out of the carnies, and the carnies were a kind of a mix too, because they had sticks in the crowd, and those sticks would basically be plants, and they would be used to embolden people from the crowd to step in and face the carnival wrestlers. So there were works going way back to the carny days. Whenever there's money involved, there's always going to be. I mean, basically, it was a con game. It was a carnival con game. But out of that con game came, you know, the wrestling style. And it's hard to really to pinpoint that in pro wrestling. Everybody debates that. It was there were works going all the way back to the early 1900s, you know, mixed in with shoots. But certainly, you can't really pinpoint a year. I mean, a lot of times people would say, like the Gotch, Hackenschmidt, the second match was where things really started to get worked, and where kayfabe came in. But it really is even prior to that, like in the Carney days. It was interesting because we had with Pat Miletich, we just came off of that. We did 90-minute episode with him, and of course, you know, UFC welterweight champion, legend, UFC Hall of Famer. He was talking about how his growing up in Iowa, his great uncle was what you call a barnstormer in the carnivals. And he was an Olympian, and what he used to do was he used to go out to the carnivals and make money beating the carnival wrestlers. And there were guys like that did that as well. So it's a wild history and a great history. And, you know, most fight fans, and going back to what I was saying about fight fans, most of them aren't really knowledgeable about the history and where all this stuff comes from.
Now, we're talking about you in pro wrestling. We talked about the King of Connecticut earlier on. I mean, tell us about the life of a wrestler, because you're very much local promotion based. Was what we saw on screen in The Wrestler, was that accurate to what it is like wrestling at a local promotion level?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, yeah, I mean, I do all the Bush League shows, small towns, and I have fun with it. Yeah, I mean, I came up with an idea related to that. When that movie first came out, I was working some shows with the Rock and Roll Express from the big stars, you know, back in the 80s, Robert Gibson, and in particular, Ricky Morton. And when that movie first came out and I first saw it, I was in the locker room with Ricky Morton. We were on a show together, and I believe it was at one of the fairground shows in Laren's, South Carolina. And we're sitting there in the back, and I talked about the movie, and I said, "Hey, Ricky, you know," I said, "they should do a reality show on you because you really are the wrestler. Because here you are, you know, sitting here at this little fairground show. You know, he had so many ups and downs in his life with, you know, child support issues and things like that, which is all public knowledge, you know, because he's talked a lot about it. And I said, man, your life really mirrors that of the wrestler, because Robert Gibbs, or Ricky Morton, rather, he was main eventing against Ric Flair back in the 80s. He just went, into WWE Hall of Fame last year. He was part of one of the hottest tag teams. But there he was in the back, you know, in a small indie show. And that's been the cool thing for me doing pro wrestling, because all this stuff has always been a hobby. We just had Shannon Rich on my show, who's had over 200 MMA fights. And I said, to compare you and I, Shannon, said, you know, we're about the same age. I had only 5 MMA competitions over the course of 3 years, whereas you had over 200. I had my last one about eight years ago. You're still going at it and still competing. So a lot of these guys that do it as a career, you know, they've got a hustle, and I've been fortunate enough that I've been in the alcoholic beverage industry for 21 years, and that's been my main source of income. All this other stuff was a hobby, and that's what Billy Wicks taught me. He told me right away, said it several times, the best advice I could give you or anybody who wants to be a fighter or a wrestler is get a job, you know, and have a career, because that money's not going to last, you know. And on the small circuits, that's where most of the guys, you know, I always say I see everybody on the way up, and I see him on the way down. And I've seen a number of guys now on the way up. Apollo Crews, who's big in WWE now. I had a few matches with him in Atlanta when he was at Curtis Hughes' school out there. And then a lot of times you see the guys that are on the way down, and it's a sad story, because if your most marketable gift is being able to deliver or take, you know, a body slam, there's not a lot of career opportunities for you after your body gives out.
And I mean, talking about the wrestler, I mean, a guy who's been around sort of that independent scene for years and puts his body through it is someone like the Necro Butcher or Necro Butcher. I mean, have you ever encountered him before on the scene?
Yes, I have. I'm trying to remember where, because there's been so many guys. But I always say, like, the guys that are big down here that do shows still that were big in the 80s, like the Barbarian, the Warlord, the Rock and Roll Express, Hacksaw Jim Duggan. These are guys I do shows with, or did shows with all the time. I actually had that show at the high school last month, the fundraising show for my old wrestling team. I called that my retirement match. Now, it could be like a Terry Funk retirement, and I might come back quite a few times, but I called that my retirement match.
Now, talk about MMA, and you got involved in Bellator when it was starting on Spike. So what was your role in that?
I was a prime marketing consultant for Bellator. I was part of a group, we called it Three Group, and we were contracted to rebrand their marketing. It was myself, John Shattuck, and Laurent Pinchot. And we brought them out of the tournament format, and I'm really proud about what I did with my role there, because my whole concept and the whole concept of the marketing plan we put together was to build stars, to cross brand with TNA Wrestling, to create storylines. And I published on YouTube, people can go and listen to it, a few hours of our meetings, of audio of meetings we had. I wasn't really allowed to publish the final marketing plan, but you can hear in those meetings. Here's just one example. I gave him the idea to book the Stefan Bonner-Tito Ortiz fight, which outdid, that was the first time that they beat UFC head-to-head in the ratings that night. And they're still using that marketing philosophy, and I called it the Rolling Stones headlining philosophy. They did Shamrock Gracie. They just did Fedor Mitrione. They had Rampage King Mo, and it's proven effective. I had I broadcast with King Mo for a company called RFC down in Tampa that runs shows a few times a year, and I had King Mo on my show. He's been on three times, and the last time we had him on, we focused a lot on marketing and booking philosophy in MMA, and there's some clips of that. You can actually listen to the whole episode. I should tell people, go to arenasports.net, the Arena Sports Network, and you can look up King's Court, and you can see all the episodes of my show. But it was the last episode I did with Mo where we talked about appealing to the casual fan and really the marketing ideas on MMA and how they mirror pro wrestling. So it's pretty interesting stuff. And King Mo's a very bright guy. And, of course, you know, one of the big stars of Bellator. But that was the marketing philosophy. And this thing we did with them, this project, it was a three-month period, and it really created the roadmap for what they're using now. And they've been using since that Stefan Bonner-Tito Ortiz fight.
Now, you've touched on it a couple of times. Let's talk about your podcast, The King's Court. What's it all about?
Well, I'll tell you, that show came about due to a rib or a prank. And what happened was Kamal Shelrus, the Prince of Persia, was a guest on a show called Snowman in the Morning with Brian Snow, who's the one who runs the Arena Sports Network. And Kamal was the guest on there, and Brian had no idea that I was hanging on the line, and Kamal's a real prankster, a real jokester. So we got towards the end of the show where Brian was about to wrap things up, and I said, Snowman, Snowman, and he said, and And he said, yes, hello, hello, because he didn't have any lines open for people to call in, so it kind of freaked him out. And I said, are you there with that there Prince of Persia? And I said, I can take that name, Aram. I've seen him on the TV. And then me and Kamal kind of improv, you know, some comedy back and forth. And we had Brian Snow cracking up. Now, he could have taken it the wrong way that we sabotaged his show, but he's got a great sense of humor. And he offered me a show after that. Well, actually, you know, he had me on a couple times after that. And then he offered me a show, which is what King's Court has become. And it's a fun entertainment and comedy show. There's a lot of storytelling. The guests are a lot of personal friends, mostly from the MMA and pro wrestling world. The first episode was an hour of comedy with UFC Hall of Famer Dan the Beast Severn. And Dan and I have done some stand-up together in the past, so we've got our comedy act down. I mentioned we've had King Mo on a number of times, New York Badass Phil Baroni. His episode was all comedy, too, and we told a lot of hilarious stories. UFC founder Art Davey, creator and founder Art Davey, that episode was a lot more serious and really cool if you want to know the origins of the UFC from the man who created it. Of course, we've had Kamal Chalroos on a few times. And from over there in England, one of my personal favorite guests we had on was Jeannie Clark, who was the ex-wife and former valet of Stone Cold Steve Austin and also of the gentleman Chris Adams. And she was, of course, a big star in the WCW days, and she's got some great stories. We had the Patriot, Del Wilkes on, WWF and WCW superstar, one of Stone Cold Steve Austin's top guests, because he's had him on a couple times because he talks about his pill addiction. So we had him on, and he paid us a compliment saying it was his favorite of all the shows that he's done. We had a UFC Women's Champion Neisha Tate on with her mom, Michelle. We're going to actually have them back on again in Season 3. And I mentioned UFC Hall of Famer Pat Miletich. His show was going to be the debut for Season 3, and it's 90 minutes long. He tells a lot of funny stories about, I used to train at his gym, Miletich gym in Austin, Texas. And he also gets a lot into his new show, The Conspiracy Farm, and into politics. We're going to have X-Pac, WWF superstar X-Pac on. You mentioned DDP. We've had DDP on. We had Shannon Rich that I mentioned. And then we try to get guests that are outside of the combat sports world as well. And we've had a number of great guests like that, like Talib Starks, who was Adam. I picked him off because he was Adam Carolla's recurring guest. He's written some books that are pretty controversial, and he was a great guest as well. So I describe it to people as a fun, entertainment, more comedy sports show. It's not like a real serious sports show because it's a lot of storytelling.
Now, with your foot in both camps then, within the MMA camp and the pro wrestling camp, do you think over in the US, do you think that MMA has now overtaken pro wrestling's popularity among the general public?
It's a great question. I actually think it's kind of dying down, at least from what I see. The popularity of MMA, at least on the local scene and the smaller shows, their attendance is down. And I think part of the reason why is the key era, the main era that we tapped into when I was with Bellator booking, in UFC, when you had the most stars was when you had your Chuck Liddells, your Tito Ortiz, your Stephen Bonners, Forrest Griffin, Matt Hughes. You had all these guys. You could name a lot of stars. I think now the UFC is getting more into the hardcore fan. There's they're more, and now Conor McGregor has helped them out tremendously. And this Conor McGregor Floyd Mayweather, the boxing match is going to help them out tremendously, and I think also help boxing. But it certainly hasn't overtaken the pro wrestling, and it depends on region of the country too. I think there's a lot of confusion still, even with people down here, as to what the difference is between MMA and pro wrestling. And I'm not talking about just people, the man on the street down here in the South. And I think that MMA, like if you think about it, when that first Ultimate Fighter season came out, that first reality show, everybody was talking about that show. And then the next couple seasons after that, it was really popular. And then I look at it from my own business with being in the liquor distribution, beer and wine distribution business. We deal with all the top sports bars, and less and less of them are paying for the UFC pay-per-views. Carolina Ale House here no longer does it. Most of the Hooters don't do it. They used to draw a ton of people. So I think the opposite. I think that from my perspective, MMA here in the U.S. is on the decline.
What do you think of the pro wrestling biz at the moment? Because certainly my opinion of it has been WWE now conquers all, pretty much, and that competition that they had with TNA back in the Asylum days seems to, TNA's taken a little bit of a step back, so it seems at the moment WWE or nothing.
Yeah, and WWE is interesting because they changed their whole model. For so many years it was all about the pay-per-view, and they started that pay-per-view business that the UFC and now Bellator have gotten into big time. And now it's all about the network. And I think the same thing with WWE. My God, look at, like, you used to see people with DX t-shirts, NWO t-shirts, and it was a hip, cool thing. And I think now pro wrestling has become very niche audience as well. And you look at, all you have to do is look at the ratings numbers, you know, what they used to do during the Attitude Era. And when WCW and WWE were going head-to-head, and like you said, with TNA, there needs to be a competitor. There needs to be another company. And one of the things that I did when I was with Bellator in the marketing role was try to get us to cross-brand and cross-promote with TNA. I mean, we got Rampage Jackson and Tito Ortiz over there in TNA and King Mo. Over there in TNA and try to cross-brand and cross-promote. I think that they could help each other. Both industries could help each other. And I think that WWE is pretty content right now in where they're at. You know, I with this network, and they make money off the network, but their ratings are never going to be what they were during that time period of the Attitude Era. Go back and, you know, when you go back and you look at that in the late 90s, early 2000s, I mean, that was, pro wrestling was pop culture. It was embedded in pop culture back then. And prior to that, you know, with the Rock and Wrestling Connection, you know, going back to the 80s, it's not so much anymore. It's become a much smaller niche kind of thing. And I also, one thing that I really don't like about pro wrestling today is with the fans, they don't sit back and enjoy the matches. They have to dissect the matches, and they get so much into, it's almost like they're trying to be bookers, and they're trying to work creatively for the company. Instead, pro wrestling is about suspending reality, sitting back, relaxing, and enjoying the show, you know, not trying to pick everything apart.
Now, you've been back to the writing recently. Tell us about your latest book, Too Handsome for Hollywood.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I had the idea to do a comedy book because I do a lot of comedy writing and some stand-up. So I say this book, it's not an autobiography, not a comedy book, not a political manifesto, but it's got elements of all three. And I had Dan the Beast Severn write a pretty funny foreword for it, which people, if they go to my Facebook, Matthew J. Granahan, MatthewJGranahan. You can follow me on there. I'm almost at the, depending how many people cancel me and then redo me at the top for allowing friends, but you can follow me on there. And I created a page for Too Handsome for Hollywood on there recently, and it was a lot of fun. I tell a lot of fun stories in the book, and I think you'll find it's pretty entertaining. It's only $9.99. It's an ebook you can get on Amazon.com. And speaking of books, I wrote a book for Stephanie Bellers, Gorgeous George from the WCW. She was Macho Man Randy Savage's valet there for years, and then she got into the punk rock scene. She was a part of the Misfits, so she crosses over between the punk rock and pro wrestling. We've been writing that book together for years, but she kind of, you know, she's pretty wild. She moves from place to place. She is coming back here to South Carolina second week of August, and she has promised me that she's going to finish this book with me. She's going to stay here for a few days and finish and knock this thing out. So we should, it's so many stories in that book. It's got to be released because her life really is a train wreck, and that is always entertaining. And all the stories that she has of the wrestlers and the punk rock people, people are going to love that when it comes out. So stay tuned for that one. But you can get Too Handsome for Hollywood at Amazon.com.